Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, February 11th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, fire departments in Northern Mendocino and Humboldt County to receive new Type 6 fire engines, and Arcata Chamber of Commerce moves to downtown Arcata. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyon, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
Senator Mike McGuire met with Northern Mendocino and Humboldt County fire chiefs to discuss newly allocated funding for the new Type 6 fire engines better equipped for rural roads. Julian Jackson reports.
Last Friday, on February 6th, Senator Mike McGuire met with fire chiefs from Briceland, Garberville, Palo Verde, Telegraph Ridge, Whitethorn, Covelo, Laytonville, Leggett, Piercy, and Westport to discuss the recent approval of additional state funding for new Type 6 fire engines. Additionally, the Phillipsville and Alder Point fire departments will be receiving refurbished trucks from some stations receiving the new ones. These modern engines are said to be more adaptable and equipped for rural narrow roads in these fire districts, especially with station-specific interchangeable equipment, and some of the engines replaced being manufactured in the 1980s. Senator McGuire particularly highlighted the level of need for these new fire trucks, as well as additional investment into fire safety in the state of California.
Each of the Type 6 fire engines are about 190,000 fully loaded. And these Type 6 fire engines, they are a desperately needed resource for each of these extremely rural and remote communities. And let's be blunt about it, these trucks, they couldn't show up soon enough because fire season is just around the corner. It's nipping at our heels, and we need to get these engines deployed as quickly as possible. Six of the 10 have already arrived. The remainder will arrive between now and the end of April. And let me be clear, this is a big win for our neighbors on the North Coast. And this win is also buttressed by some game-changing investments that we've championed and we've made across the great state of California. In addition to the investments with these 10 new fire engines, we have begun transitioning all 3,000 seasonal CAL FIRE firefighters to full-time status. Why that is important? It is because fire season in this state is 365 damn days a year. We've doubled the number of CAL FIRE firefighters over the last 9 years, going from 6,700 to now 12,500 today. And we're about to hire an additional 1,600 CAL FIRE firefighters over the next 36 months. And in the coming 4 years, we'll invest, the state of California will invest an additional $5 billion in state funding for vegetation management, a dead and dying tree removal, creating wildfire breaks around rural communities. We've already invested $3 billion over the last 4 years.
Chief Tanner Spees of Telegraph Ridge Volunteer Fire Department gave more of an inside perspective as to the use of these engines.
In the remote southern Humboldt area, the rural and volunteer fire departments are often the first and sometimes only line of defense when wildfire emergencies strike. So we cover large, rugged areas and limited resources, long response times, and communities that are miles from the nearest help. And the reality is rural departments are easy to forget. When funding decisions are made far from places like ours, the needs of small volunteer-driven agencies can fall through the cracks. And that's not just frustrating for us, it's unacceptable when lives, homes, and entire communities are on the line. That's why I want to start by saying thank you to Senator McGuire and his office for stepping up and investing in rural fire protection. These new Type 6 all-risk engines are a game changer for the North Coast. They're designed specifically for the terrain we operate in, narrow roads, steep grades, limited access, and wildland-urban interface threats. They're nimble, capable, and versatile, allowing us to respond not only to wildfires, but also medical calls, vehicle accidents, structure fires, and disasters. So equally important, this was a regional effort. By working together, departments were able to standardize equipment, save significant money through a group bid process, and set ourselves up for cross-training and shared staffing. For many of these departments, this is the first brand new apparatus they've ever received, including Telegraph Ridge, first brand new truck we've ever had in our department's history.
Chief Speeds, thank you so much. Very, very grateful for your work. I also want to say thank you so much to Chief Pape, who could not be with us today from Timber Cove. He was also one of the leaders who helped drive this, and very grateful for his incredible work. And thank you so much to Chief Pape.
After that additional comment from Senator McGuire, Leggett Valley's Chief Eli Ryder emphasized this need of support for rural fire departments.
In the past decade, we've seen the local economy shift, a pandemic, a shifting climate that have all changed the landscape of our work. Longer dry seasons, hotter summers, and more frequent wind events have increased our call volume and extended our deployments. Training requirements have become more rigorous, operating costs have risen, and maintenance on equipment is never ending. Keeping our trucks on the road costs more now, and the demands dedication by all the volunteers. The most pressing challenge, however, is invisible on the road. It's the toll on our members. These are ordinary people with families, jobs, and lives outside of the fire service. Repeated emergencies, heavy weight of responsibility, and a growing call volume constrain their mental health. Protecting the people who protect us is a priority.
To see one of these new Type 6 fire engines in person and up close, stay tuned for events coming in March and April showcasing the trucks in the local area, or the Leggett Mountain Folk Festival in June. I've been Julian Jackson reporting for KMUD News.
This March, the Arcata Chamber of Commerce will be moving to the Jacoby Storehouse in downtown Arcata from their current location on Hinden Road near Gentoli. The Arcata Chamber of Commerce is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes and helps local businesses through networking events and providing resources for growth. They help support events like Oysterfest and the Kinetic Sculpture Race, as well as other events like the Summer Concert Series. KMUD News spoke to Gloria Baker, the Operations and Events Manager at the Arcata Chamber of Commerce, for more about what they do.
So the Arcata Chamber of Commerce is a membership-based organization. We are a nonprofit. We're 501c6. And so anyone who needs help with any kind of business can join the chamber and receive lots of benefits, from marketing assistance to content creation and workshops and discounts on events. And then just overall support, you know, if somebody's like, I have an open office, we can connect them with somebody else that's looking for a space. And so it's really a business resource that is here for the community. And we also do a lot of events now that help all of our businesses, but also people that don't have storefronts. So we're a pretty well-rounded business resource.
The chamber will actually be returning to their former location, as the Arcata Chamber office was located at the Jacoby Storehouse from 1974 to 1986.
So Kevin Hoover from the Mad River Union and Camille from Cal Poly Humboldt Library Collection, they did a little research for us because I knew we were here at some point, but I didn't know the time frame. And so Kevin Hoover went in and found all kinds of old Arcata Chamber stuff and then narrowed down when we used to be in the storehouse.
Moving spaces moves the Chamber of Commerce closer to the heart of town, where many, if not most, of the events that they put together are held. The Chamber has been at their current spot for approximately 10 years, and Baker looks forward to the closer proximity to town.
Well, it's already very much a community. It's nice having multiple businesses all around us. We can have meetings easier and just pop down to some of the local spots like Cafe Brio or Familia. And, you know, it's a place where we can have our door open and people just kind of walk by all throughout the day. And that's kind of what we want, you know, especially as visitors start coming to town during the busy season. Like, we can just be here and be way more accessible and be a resource. I think being downtown will really not necessarily change our identity, but push our mission a little bit more, as we can be more in the forefront rather than being, I mean, I consider the office we were in, I always say, like, it's in the cuts. Like, we can't just walk into town. We can't just, you know, people don't really know where to find us. And so it's going to change how we can be here for our community. And it's not just moving offices. It really is going to give us a different perspective and different inspiration on how we can be supportive.
The Chamber will be moving into their new location starting in March, and for more information on what they do, the website is arcatachamber.com. Turning to Mendocino, The Prescribed Burn Association is leveling up with help from the Mendocino Fire Safety Council. Sarah Reith from the Mendocino Fire Safety Podcast reports.
The Prescribed Burn Association is leveling up with help from the Mendocino County Fire Safe Council. It turns out prescribed fire and pizza are a popular combination. More than 40 people came to the Anderson Valley Brewing Company on a balmy California winter day for pizza and an informational event about the Mendocino County Prescribed Burn Association. MCPBA steering committee members took questions from landowners, land managers, and curious residents from microclimates all over the county. Visitors from Laytonville were interested in the confluence of fire, forest health, and the Eel River, while coastal residents asked about native plants. This meeting was the first in-person event for the organization since the pandemic. Also for the first time, MCPBA has a paid staff person who can focus on the logistics of getting more controlled fire on the ground. Emily Lord is the Beneficial Fire and Education Coordinator for the Mendocino County Fire Safe Council, which hired her in part to increase intentional burns in the county.
A lot of what I've been able to do is provide logistical support. So in the upcoming year, we're looking to do more events like this where we're engaging with community members and understanding the needs for fire in the area.
Glancing at the results from a survey she handed out before the event, she saw that in addition to more burning, attendees had a strong interest in more opportunities to learn about fire, like workshops and lecture series. Jennifer Smallwood drove to Anderson Valley from Point Arena to find out if prescribed burns are a fit for her community. The tiny coastal city is much cooler than the inland part of the county, but she described a set of conditions that make it very clear why residents there are starting a FireWise community. Point Arena includes some national forest land.
So we're really interested in all their dead and dying trees and what they're going to do about it and what we can do about it together. And also the geography of Point Arena is really interesting. There are draws and ways that the ocean air comes in between these different little crevices and valleys.
This means that wind could pick up speed and tear through town, igniting dried vegetation in a scenario that's become all too familiar in communities with only one way in and one way out.
There's just so many ifs. If they happened, we'd be in a world of hurt. So yeah, we really do need to clean up the space a little bit so that we have a little more defensible space, which is why we're becoming a FireWise community.
Dr. Michael Jones, the UC Extension Forester for Mendocino County and a Mendocino County Fire Safe Council board member, is one of the founding members of the Mendocino County Prescribed Burn Association and its current chair. He says the entire county is adapted to and dependent on fire.
What changes is the frequency of that fire, right? If you're on the coast, fire is an important part of the ecosystem on the coast, but maybe it's not as frequent. Like maybe interior, like Ukiah, you would have a fire return interval where fire would be an important disturbance every decade or two. But on the coast, maybe it's every 50 years. So it's still, there's an important relationship with fire. It's just that kind of different scales and different impacts.
There are also different reasons to burn. Many landowners focus on burning dried vegetation to protect their homes and properties, but Jones also encourages people to incorporate ecological management objectives into their burns. This can complicate a burn plan, but the objectives don't have to be at cross purposes.
The best time to burn range or grasslands is in the spring, right? That's when you kind of are timing for ecological management, trying to manage for invasives. That also happens to be the same time of year that nesting birds, especially those that like grasses and shrubs, have active broods or starting to build nests in that space. So you don't want to destroy that habitat. So you might think about, can I burn before that window? Can I burn after that window of nesting? Or does it, maybe even, does it mean that we're just not going to burn this time of year?
Jones and other experts who volunteer with the Mendocino County Prescribed Burn Association are happy to help design burn plans and provide volunteer labor when the day arrives. They have long-standing lines of communication with fire departments, CAL FIRE, and air quality management officials. Olivia Parra is a steering committee member who moved to Mendocino County with her young family shortly after the devastating fires of 2017 and 2018.
I was just afraid.
She attended an event at UC Hopland Research and Extension Center, where Jones and other early MCPBA members were extolling the benefits of fire on the landscape. On my timeline, as steering committee member Kyle Farmer put it, not accidents timeline. Parra was hooked. She took her toddler to a burn and set a drip torch to grasslands as the child played with some toys the rancher had on hand for the grandkids. She's not a burn boss, but her relationship with fire is based on respect, not fear.
I think it's so valuable for people just to experience it. Like, I can feel, I can hear the intensity of fire. I'm never going to be the one advising people on how to conduct these burns, But it's given me enough confidence to like understand my own home and what can I do by myself.
After she moved into town from the country, she used her knowledge of fire to inform the process of rebuilding the house at her new location.
I would really encourage people to be involved with the PBA, not even just because they have big tracts of land that they're managing, but even to better understand how they can protect their own home, even if they just live in town. And it's cool. It's also just fun, right? And it's just great people. Like, I mean, other things, even if it's not fire, like, so much about prescribed burns is all the prep work before you get to the fire. So learning how to use a chainsaw, learning how to clear fuels, like learning like, okay, I want to burn that over there, but if I don't clear all this other stuff, I'm going to kill my beautiful oak that I'm trying to save. So a lot of it is even just learning, like, what are the things I need to do before fire?
The social aspect is key, according to Emily Lord. She says the PBA model is based on a tradition of
neighbors helping neighbors, where one person puts out a call for, I need help on this day, and everyone shows up, and then they all eat a big meal together, and then the expectation is you will then help your neighbor in return. That is what we try to embody from the same grassroots perspective.
She's hoping that with more workshops, more organization, and more expertise, more people will call on the PBA for help with thoughtful burning.
Email us. Email us at mendopba@gmail.com. We would love to work with anyone and everyone who's interested in getting beneficial fire on the ground and learning about fire in their neighborhood, in their ecosystem. And we'll hope to see you out on the fire line and at one of our upcoming workshops or events.
To find out how you can get involved and learn more, you can also visit the MCPBA website at calpba.org/Mendocino-PBA or just enter Mendocino PBA in your search engine and you'll get there.
In state news, new California bill introduced to curb abuse in the staffing industry, Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
California lawmakers are considering a bill introduced Tuesday to regulate the temporary staffing industry in an attempt to protect workers and weed out bad actors. The Staffing Agency Fair Employment Act, or SAFE Act, would require mandatory registration and proof of workers' compensation insurance and financial capacity. Dave Koyman, president and CEO of Arena Staffing in Ontario, says the authorities have prosecuted a slew of shady operators in recent years.
People are in jail for withholding payroll taxes. They're not paying workers' compensation. It just makes it extremely hard for the companies that are legitimate and doing things right to compete on a price level when people are not following the rules.
The bill aims to be proactive, establishing oversight to make sure companies comply with the law before anybody gets hurt. It's also intended to make sure companies can no longer avoid accountability simply by closing up shop and reopening under a different name. California temporary staffing agencies generate more than $41 billion a year and employ more workers than temporary agencies in any other state. Koyman says he's seen cases where fraudulent companies falsify their workers' compensation documentation, which can leave injured workers and the taxpayers with huge medical bills.
They're piggybacking on other policies, they're showing fake certificates, and they're just crossing their fingers hoping they don't have injuries. And when they do have injuries, they just try to settle them with all the money that they're saving that they would have to pay in normal workers' comp.
The SAFE Act is sponsored by Senator Eloise Gomez-Reyes and the nonprofit Partnership Organization for Workplace Ethics and Reform, known as POWER. Because the bill is brand new, there is no registered opposition as of yet. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, Republicans push election law changes, Dems blast move as attempt to take over elections, or even the country. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The title of the hearing was Make Elections Great Again, How to Restore Trust and Integrity in Federal Elections. And to Republican lawmakers, that trust, integrity, and making elections great has a very specific meaning. Republican Brian Stile of Wisconsin is chair of the Committee on House Administration and the author of a bill he calls the Make Elections Great Again Act.
Here's the top line. Elections should end on Election Day. You should need a photo identification to cast a ballot. You must be a citizen of the United States of America to vote in a federal election. We need audible paper ballots, and we shouldn't be sending ballots to people that don't request them. These reforms alone will improve voter confidence, strengthen election integrity, and continue to make it easy to vote and hard to cheat.
He preemptively blasted Democratic criticism of his measure as outlandish and false, but that criticism was quick to come.
I asked the American people this: do you want Donald Trump running your elections? Do you want Pam Bondi or Kristi Noem running your elections?
Joe Morelle is a Democrat from New York. He blasted the Make Elections Great Again Act, as well as a similar measure in the Senate called the SAVE Act.
But really, all these bills have the same outcome. They are the Trump elections takeover bills. We know this because the president has said so himself. He said, we want to take over. We should take over the voting in at least 15 places.
He says Trump and congressional Republicans are terrified of losing the next election because voters have rejected Trump's policies by defeating Trump-aligned candidates in elections across the country.
Because of these failures, Republicans know they have one hope at winning the next election: change the rules of the game, destroy the rule of law, and desert any last remaining shred of allegiance to the United States Constitution. Redrawing congressional lines to make them better for Republicans, changing the rules of elections, brutalizing American citizens who exercise their rights under the U.S. Constitution. This scheme is not just how Republicans plan to take over our elections, it's how they plan to take over our country.
Democrat Norma Torres of California says the administration is hell-bent on blocking millions of people from voting. People who demonstrate against Republican policies, new young voters, seniors who cannot afford a passport, and women who marry and change their names.
The Republican election bills being considered are a direct attack on dissent of current Republican policies.
She noted Trump's call to federalize elections, and she says we need to ask, what does that actually mean?
Are we talking about military with machine guns at our local school election stations, or masked, untrained, heavily armed ICE agents surrounding our community centers? What are we talking about here? The FBI just raided a local election office with the Director of National Intelligence tagging along like an obedient dog, allegedly in pursuit of a fever dream conspiracy theory about the 2020 elections that no sane person believes.
One way or another, voting in this year's election day may be a little different from past elections, or maybe a lot different. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In National Native News, Brian Bull reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Protecting tribal sovereignty is a top discussion at the National Congress of American Indians 2026 Winter Session, which is taking place this week in Washington, D.C. NCAI President Mark Macaro highlighted the importance of tribal sovereignty in a State of Indian Nations address. Macaro says before there was a U.S., there were sovereign tribal nations.
Our sovereignty was not created by treaties, nor granted by Congress. It is inherent and existed before colonization. Treaties did not give us sovereignty, they recognized it. The Constitution did not define us, it acknowledged us. Federal laws did not create our rights, it memorialized them. And yet, for centuries, our sovereignty has been attacked, and attempts continue to constrain and diminish it. Yet our nations continue to govern, continue to lead, to teach, to resist, and to rise.
Macaro says recent attacks include calls by Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt to limit tribal sovereignty, which Macaro says is appalling. Tribal leaders in Oklahoma agree with Macaro's sentiment. Reggie Wassenaar is governor of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma.
This day and age, we shouldn't have to ask why tribes have a sovereignty. We shouldn't have to ask what the tribe's capabilities are, how they can function, how they can prosper, and who are tribes. That should not be asked today.
Wassenaar and Macaro say tribal leaders are often educating elected officials about American Indian history, tribal sovereignty, and the U.S. government's trust and treaty responsibilities. Before every census, the federal government picks several test sites, focusing on hard-to-reach areas. But the Bureau has canceled that testing at four of the six regions, including two that cover Arizona tribal lands. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, this isn't the first time the census has changed course with Indian country.
In fact, this also happened in 2016, when two reservations in Washington and South Dakota were nixed, citing budget uncertainty and funding shortages.
Now we're in 2026.
That's census consultant Sandra Mitrovich, who co-leads the Natives Count Coalition. She's also a member of the Berry Creek Rancheria of Maidu Indians of California.
In the last two decennials, not only have we had the undercount, but we've had this cancellation of test sites for tribal areas twice.
Mitrovich says one concern is that the Trump administration is considering to use Postal Service staff to replace temporary census workers to conduct the count and cut down on costs.
A lot of households are left invisible to the census, and they also have non-traditional addresses.
In 2020, the nonprofit Native American Rights Fund reported that more than 80% of all registered indigenous voters in Arizona outside of Metro Phoenix and Tucson rely solely on P.O. boxes. This time around, San Carlos and White Mountain Apache homes in Arizona, as well as Cherokee households in North Carolina, are being left out. The Census Bureau would not say why.
And how are we going to say that we're going to carry out this fair and full representation that this survey is supposed to provide of the country?
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And on this day in 1978, the longest walk by Native activists began. A startup ceremony took place on Alcatraz Island, where the group then proceeded to travel by foot from Sacramento to Washington, D.C., to build awareness of treaty rights and injustice. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Julian Jackson, Suzanne Potter, Sarah Reif, Christopher Martinez, and Brian Bull. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Matt Cardos.